Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Peter Hart of the Media Watch Group FAIR, who assesses the corporate media's coverage of protests against the proposed construction of an Islamic community center two blocks from Ground Zero in New York City. Talat Hamdani, mother of 9/11 victim Salman Hamdani, who responds to those protesting the building of an Islamic center near the site where her son died as he attempted to rescue victims of the September 11th terrorist attack. And organic horticulturist Laura Kelly, who talks about the disappearance of honeybees, issues of pollution and food production, and the philosophy which guides her daily life. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
With the expiration of the 15-year-old Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, START, U.S. officials can no longer conduct on-site inspections of long-range Russian nuclear missiles. Before START expired in December, inspections of Russian nuclear weapon sites took place every few weeks. According to the Washington Post, the new START treaty is on hold in the U.S. Senate, blocked by Republican leaders like Arizona Senator John Kyle, who was surprised to learn that on-site nuclear inspections had stopped. Without on-site inspections of nuclear sites, American and Russian governments must rely on other methods to estimate nuclear stockpiles, including reconnaissance satellites and radar, which are less reliable. Many observers believe it's cynical partisan politics at play blocking the treaty, with Republicans unwilling to give President Obama any arms control victories before this November's midterm congressional election. In 2009, Congress spent $29 billion on foreign aid to assist poor developing countries, nearly double the dollars to fight poverty and disease than a decade ago. But aid advocates are growing frustrated with ineffective programs and current political hamstrings on the Agency for International Development, AID, which is often overshadowed by the State Department. A major drive to reform foreign aid is underway in Congress. While aid groups praise President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for working to link international development to national security, they are still waiting for a detailed global development policy. Advocates are hoping to make AID a full cabinet-level agency with control over its own political agenda and budget. The push for reform is fueled in part by a slow and uneven response to the humanitarian disaster caused by the massive earthquake in Haiti. A top-level congressional aide recently told Congressional Quarterly, Haiti has made much clearer the divisions between the State Department and AID over who should be in charge. Nancy Birdsall, head of the Center for Global Development, a respected Washington, D.C. think tank, recently complained disorganization at the federal level is stalling action. Someone and some agency must take charge and be accountable to Congress for development dollars and programs. Facing ongoing budget cuts and layoffs, teachers' unions and the Obama administration are in an intense battle over education policy. Opposition to the administration's Race to the Top program and other initiatives by Education Secretary Arne Duncan is growing. Critics say Duncan, Chicago's former school superintendent, is pushing an education agenda full of market-based reforms like performance pay for teachers and support for charter schools. Responding to growing union pressure, more states are opting out of applying for the $4 billion in Race to the Top education grants. Teachers' unions, which donated over $50 million in campaign contributions to Democrats in 2008, now complain labor and community groups are being pushed aside in the drive for school reform. In Colorado, the education reform law will mean merit pay for teachers, increased use of standardized tests, and changes to teacher tenure rules. Meanwhile, Colorado has already cut $340 million in education funding. Unions say local school districts will be forced to deal with the funding shortfall, leading to more layoffs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker. We'll be right back.
controversy over the location of a proposed Islamic community center, 2 blocks from Ground Zero in New York City, erupted into a late summer firestorm with possible political consequences in this November's midterm congressional election. Plans for the building include a culinary school, an auditorium, a swimming pool, a basketball court, and space for prayer. The Park 51 project, as it's known, is being led by Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, a Sufi Muslim, who was selected as an emissary to the Middle East on behalf of the Bush administration in 2007, and continues to participate in State Department trips abroad to foster better understanding of religion in U.S. society. Opponents of the Islamic Center assert that the site is too close to hallowed ground, where more than 2,700 people were killed during Al-Qaeda's September 11th attack on the World Trade Center. Supporters of the project respond that condemning all of Islam for the 9/11 attacks is based on ignorance, and back the imam's stated goal of building bridges across religious lines. But inflammatory media coverage of the controversy has amplified the voices of hate and intolerance, with, for example, Fox News commentator Dick Morris condemning the building project as a command center for terrorism, and former House Speaker Newt Gingrich comparing Islam with Nazism. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Peter Hart, activism director with the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. Hart assesses the corporate media's coverage of the Ground Zero Islamic Center controversy by examining many news outlets' culpability for disseminating misinformation and a failure to forcefully respond to smears and innuendo.
I think it's one of those stories where you can see every deplorable tendency in the corporate media on display at one time for over a sustained number of days and weeks. You have a story that's really a non-story pushed into the mainstream media by shadowy and sometimes not so shadowy forces on the right. You have a mainstream media that, when confronted with this story, does little to unspin or unpack some of the bogus allegations, the fear-mongering, the Islamophobia that is at the heart of the story. And then you have successive rounds of coverage that look at it as a political controversy, so that excuses another day of engaging in this nonsense, looks at it as a through a partisan lens, which Democrats, which Republicans are lining up on which side. That's, I think, the essence of this story, the shortage of courage in our political circles and in our media circles speaks volumes about where we are some 9 years after the 9/11 attacks and where we are in terms of how Americans talk about Islam and Islam and politics.
One of the points of contention in this argument about whether this mosque should be located 2 blocks from Ground Zero in New York City is the character of the man behind the mosque building proposal, and that's Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf. He's certainly someone, while being criticized on the right, was an emissary for the Bush administration, having traveled to the Middle East on behalf of the Bush State Department at least twice in 2007. He continues in that role under the Obama administration. How has the media handled the smears against this particular fellow, who seems to be an ally of President George W. Bush, certainly someone the right has great fondness for?
Yeah, I mean, the coverage has sort of vacillated between awful and terrible, with a couple of exceptions. And it's sort of frustrating to talk about this, because there's no issue here, really. So you are responding to this ginned-up nonsense. This is a Sufi imam who has no particularly strong political allegiances, certainly none to groups that we would associate with militant Islam or even militant advocacy of a Palestinian cause or anything like that. There's really nothing to this idea that he represents a particularly dangerous strain of Islam. Far from it. As you mentioned, he was an emissary of the Bush administration, continuing in that role in the Obama administration. That's part of the reason he's not been speaking out, is because he's actually in the middle of a tour to promote the idea that America is tolerant of Islam, if you want to pile the irony on top of the rest of this story. So you have a character, a central character in this, who does not fit the bill. This story was pushed forward by a handful of right-wing bloggers and folks in the Rupert Murdoch media empire who decided that the way to make this politically viable and salient was to lie about every aspect of it. So we have a mosque that's not entirely a mosque, that isn't being built on ground zero, that isn't being led by a terror imam. There are long stories, you know, long-form journalism. You can read, I think, a piece in the New York Times, there was one in the Washington Post, that try to get at who this guy is now several weeks into this story. It's a little late at this point to try to set the record straight after you've let the narrative sit idle for so long, unchallenged. But you do read these stories and you realize that he was considered something of a bridge builder in the American Islamic community and in the political circles that he was a part of. So it's kind of shocking that the accusations would be leveled against someone like him, precisely because he was held up as an example of exactly the type of Muslim we wanted speaking out after 9/11 and spreading messages of interfaith dialogue and tolerance. This is exactly what this guy's been doing. A couple years ago, he was on a show with Glenn Beck, and they got along famously about the need to do this. When the Park 51 development was first announced, his wife was on Fox News Channel, and it was heralded as a good idea. The politics changed, and folks on the right saw this as a golden opportunity to find the kind of wedge issue they need to run in election years, and they ran with it. And the media have been trailing a couple steps behind, not really doing much of anything to unpack this completely bogus story.
Tell us if you think the political motivation here, if any, is really predicated on the idea that some points could be scored by conservative Republican candidates in this November's important midterm election.
We have two choices when you're looking at this story. Either the people who pushed this story did it because they simply hate Islam and want to spread false messages, or they did this because they knew it would be politically useful to do it. And I think the latter explanation makes more sense. The fact that you have seen this outpouring of anti-Muslim, anti-mosque protests in other parts of the country, in Tennessee, in Southern California, that goes to show you that they're trying to tap something deeper here, the kind of cultural resentment that you usually see in an election year, particularly in a midterm election year when you know that you need to come up with issues to excite your base, since the base of a party is generally who turns out in an election year such as this one. We know the Democratic Party base is less motivated to vote in 2010, and we know that the Republican base needs issues like this. So you have these stories where you can see Republican politicians across the country and pollsters and campaign advisors saying, listen, the way to campaign on this issue is to look at your opponent, point at him or her and say, listen, what's your position on the Ground Zero mosque? They effectively want to make this a national issue. And I think based on the way the media have been covering it, it's a smart move. And I think a really tragic lesson in what kind of things one can do in order to run an election campaign based on fear and innuendo and nonsense.
That was Peter Hart, activism director with the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Contact FAIR at area code 212-633-6700 or visit their website at fair.org. During the sometimes ugly debate about the proposed location of an Islamic community center two blocks from the site of the September 11th terrorist attacks in New York City, family members of 9/11 victims have often been quoted as expressing opposition to the project. Many have said that the location at an abandoned Burlington Coat Factory building opens up old wounds, is too close to hallowed ground, or just plain hurtful. Arguments which counter that another mosque has been located for years just four blocks from the World Trade Center site fail to change the minds of many 9/11 family members who are still grieving for loved ones lost. But the mother of one 9/11 victim has a very different perspective from the majority of family members quoted in the media. Talat Hamdani's son Salman, a New York City police cadet and emergency medical technician, was killed on September 11th when he went to the burning Twin Towers to assist in rescuing victims of the attack. When Talat did not hear from her son in the days after 9/11, she was told that as a Muslim, he may have been arrested by the FBI as a terrorist suspect. The New York Post newspaper, in a sensational headline, proclaimed that Salman was either missing or hiding. The unfounded accusations of her son's complicity with terrorism compounded a mother's grief when Talat was informed 6 months after the attack that Salman's remains were located under the World Trade Center rubble. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Talat, an active member of the group 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, who responds to those protesting the building of an Islamic center near the site where her son died as he attempted to rescue victims of the attack.
I understand, you know, many people died, 2,700 died, and some of them were Muslims. They were people of all faith, all ethnicities, and even different nations also, who were not American citizens, and they died over there. And there were many other Muslims, you know, South Asians who died, who were not even reported missing because maybe they were not legal, and maybe no one knows. The cab drivers and all those other, you know, bystanders. But to say that it's hallowed ground, yes, it is a hallowed ground. But this cultural center, the Muslim cultural center, is not being built on the footprints. There are a few churches over there, the Trinity Church is on the footprint of the Twin Towers. There's a synagogue over there. I have no objection to any place of worship or faith. But for them to object, the protesters, whoever they are, for them to say that it is a sensitive issue. Yes, it's sensitive, but what about the sensitivities of all of the people who are being targeted as painted by a broad brush as all Muslims are terrorists? And to me, it is an issue of my fundamental right, freedom of religion. The people that were murdered that day by Al-Qaeda were not murdered because of their faith or race or ethnicity. They were murdered because they were Americans and they believed in the American values of liberty, democracy, freedom of faith, pursuing your own faith. And not to honor those values, I don't think it is appropriate. It's a disgrace if you don't hold on to those values for which all those people died that day.
Talat, what is your response to people who talk about the presence of a mosque being very hurtful, that it reopens old wounds, that it's too close to the hallowed ground where your own son died? How do you respond to the idea that somehow the entire Islamic faith is responsible for 9/11?
Yes, it's a case of collective guilt, which is not right. But then if you look at the history, look at our history, we have done that over the past years. You know, there was a time when the Catholics were not allowed to, you know, pray in Georgia. The Mormons were thrown out, you know. So it's something, I call it initiation into the American system that we need to prove. But I think, you know, this has gone too far, and it has been complicated. It has been, you know, made complex by the politicians, I think, on both sides, I have to say now, who are exploiting this issue to benefit their own selfish goals, agendas to win the political elections. And it is, you know, it is very wrong. It's cruel, it's unethical. Our blood has been shed, and to exploit such a big tragedy for your own selfish goals. I mean, Senator Harry Reid came out and said, you know, they should move from there, and, you know, other people came out. If you cannot defend the Constitution, I'd say, then you need not be in the Congress, whether Senate or, you know, a congressperson, then you should not be there. Then resign and let someone else get into that seat so they can defend the Constitution. Because to me, it is about the whole community, you know. There's a division. Our country has been divided along the lines of faith now, which is not good. We need to heal. We need to come together and heal. And the best way to heal is to have this cultural center whose objective is to reconcile and build bridges.
Are you in favor of dialogue with the opponents of this Islamic center being built two blocks from Ground Zero? Would you like to sit down with these people face to face? Or do you think that any negotiation would be some kind of invitation to persecution?
What is there to negotiate, Scott? What am I going to negotiate? My son died. He was a Muslim. I'm a Muslim. I am, you know, so what is there to negotiate? The cultural center is legal, legitimate, you know, it's being built on private property with proper zoning. Because the sentiment of 60% of people do not agree with it doesn't mean that we have to relinquish our rights. Why do we have to relinquish our rights? If they don't like the cultural center, they don't have to go there. You don't have to visit it. Nobody wants you, asking you to go there and force you to go there. You go to your own churches and synagogues or your temples, wherever you want to go to pray. But to deny a faith to have their religious place over there, which is more of a, you know, like a YMCA is going to be an MCC, like a JCC is going to be an MCC, Muslim Cultural Center, and the objective is to build bridges. Imam is on a state visit. He is our emissary to the Middle East since President Bush's time.
Right, right.
And to demonize him, you know, they're demonizing President Obama, that he is a Muslim, as though it is a crime to be a Muslim. The White House had to come out and make a categorically statement that, no, he's a Christian. I don't think that was necessary.
That was Talat Hamdani, mother of 9/11 victim Salman Hamdani, an active member of the group 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Contact the group at area code 212-598-0970 or visit their website at peacefultomorrows.org. Laura Kelly grew up in a family that lived off the land on Cape Cod. Employing the knowledge gleaned in her early years, Kelly has worked for the past 18 years as a beekeeper, organic landscaper and designer, a nutritionist and naturalist. She owns Littlefield Landscapes in northeastern Massachusetts, where the horticulturist helps others support an organic lifestyle. Kelly offered one of 200 workshops at the 36th Annual Northeast Organic Farming Conference, August 13th through August 15th, at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She presented a workshop called Edible Landscapes that focused on the symbiotic relationships among humans, other animals, and plants. After her workshop, she spoke with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus about her observations on the disappearance of honeybees, issues of pollution and food production, and the philosophy which guides her daily life.
I started off with plants and animals, as you know, and then as I grew older, I started planting plants for money, landscaping. I'm a land designer. And then I realized that I wasn't getting stung very often. Our pollinators were disappearing in the 90s. So I started studying about honeybees and then learned that it's more than just here's a bee, here's a plant, here's an animal, here's a human. We're all together and we're actually a symbiotic relationship and we matter to each other. And right now, what the humans are doing is depleting the planet due to, you know, overuse of toxins in the air, in the water, in the soil. And we're seeing those reactions in nature with our honeybees disappearing. Our frogs are switching sexes, our whales are reproducing females more than males, et cetera, et cetera. We can see it, we can say it, we see it in a science lab, we say it. What is it going to take to get the humans to actually shift enough to change the impact we're having on the planet right now into a more positive direction to help protect us and save us and keep us healthy for future generations? So this is what drives me. You know, I am a beekeeper and I see them every single day. I learn something new. To me, they're a reflection of us. So what they're going through, we're going through. They're not able to reproduce honey right now. That means they're not able to reproduce their own food source. We're the same way. What does that mean? That means humans are not able to produce our own food source. And that's correct because we're now creating things out of a science lab called genetically modified organisms.
I'm going to back you up a second. What do you mean they can't produce their own food? Why can't they produce honey?
We don't know. It's mysterious. In 2007 was the mysterious disappearance of honeybees, which meant when a bee gets sick, it will not go home to actually contaminate their home, their hive. So they were disappearing, and it was such a mystery. We didn't know what was going on. Worldwide, we lost a third of the bees worldwide. In 2009, in the winter, we now have lost another half over the winter. Their immune systems are so depleted because of their food source. It all boils down to food. How are we feeding ourselves? themselves? How are the bees feeding themselves? How do the plants get fed? The way that we're treating our food sources, we as in humans, is depleting everything else. So genetically modified organism is a dead food. There's not enough nutritional value to keep bees healthy, which means we are also depleting ourselves. So we should be careful on how we're growing things. I believe that our dollar is our vote every single day. Each one of us can actually put our dollar towards an organization in a direction that that organization is helping the planet and doing right by you know, their standards and quality. And we need to pay attention to what that really means. And that is the direction that we need to go in for our next generations to be here healthy and happy.
When you say organization, are you talking about how we just spend our consumer dollars, whatever we do with it, or are you talking about a specific organization?
In general, I would say absolutely everything. You know, where do we go buy our gas? Where do we go to a restaurant? Where do we buy our clothing? Right now, we're losing honeybees. What does that mean? No bees equals no food. I mean, we just don't get that. I think we, you know, can say it and we can see it, but are we doing enough about it? No, we haven't. We haven't taken glyphosate out of the picture yet. Glyphosate is Roundup, and that is depleting not just, you know, our food sources, but our soil. You know, the microorganisms that's mandatory for growing our plants are gone. So they say if bees leave the planet, we only have 5 years to live. Honeybees are the most aggressive pollinators in the world. Sure, there are other pollinators, the bumblebees and the butterflies, you know, even human pollinators now. It's a new job line. They're out there. You know, it takes one bee actually pollinates 30 apple trees, and one human can do one apple tree. We cannot reproduce honey in a science lab or wax or honeybees. So we need to take care, and we need to just switch our habits. You know, and just switching the way you treat your land, your own soil outside. You know, if we could put worms back, you know, through compost tea, you know, then it would fortify your root system. In 2 years, it'll be self-sustaining. There are ways, and it's about listening and learning and shifting and caring. You know, how are we going to, you know, the next 10 years defines what the next, you know, 100 years is going to be.
That was Laura Kelly. Contact her at area code 774-353-6511 or visit her website at littlefieldlandscapes.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.